Welcome to Scaling Software Teams, a weekly podcast to help software leaders navigate fast growth without losing the magic that made that growth possible. I'm your host, Wes Winham. Today, I'm joined by Austin Broyles. Austin's resume features a laundry list of blue chip tech logos, including Google, Lyft, and Square. Today, Austin is the Director of Engineering at Primer, a Bay Area company using machine learning and natural language processing to locate insights in large datasets. Their technology does the work that a human analyst might otherwise do. In this episode, we talk about Austin's experience transitioning into a management role at Google and how he is splitting leadership between machine learning and pure software engineering teams in his current role. We also dive into the story of how he increased his offer acceptance rate by being smarter about when his candidates ate sandwiches during the interview. This conversation touched on the importance of challenging internal assumptions and using data to evaluate your interview. And now, here's my conversation with Austin Broyles. Austin Broyles, thank you so much for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams.
Thanks for having me.
Austin, what got you into building software?
I think, like a lot of people, I got into software wanting to build games. So all the first forays into building programs were building really silly games.
Nice. So like just for yourself, for your friends, like how'd you get started in the games?
Mostly for myself, but I would collaborate with friends. I think the first one I remember was a Zork-style kind of screen text-based navigation that featured Beavis and Butthead in one of the scenes.
Nice. You're in a room. what's a career inflection point that's led you to where you are today? I know you've been at Google, Square, Lyft, Intercom, so you've seen lots of different ways to do engineering. And what kind of got you where you are now?
So Google was definitely a place where we saw lots of scale and was able to learn from a lot of other great engineers. My dream was always to go on to start a company. And I think Google's scale was far from feeling like that. So I left Google after several years to join Square, which was about 30 engineers at the time. Which gave me a great look at a much earlier stage company. I got to wear lots of different hats, tackle problems at a much larger scale to the company, and got to take on large projects as a result. And so that was a great inflection point. Went on to meet a co-founder there and start a company. In many ways, it kind of led to that dream coming true.
Awesome. So you felt like that Square opportunity, their early 30 folks, that's what really kind of gave you that opportunity to start your own thing.
Yeah, definitely.
And when did you transition to being a leader? Were you leading teams at Square, or did that happen later?
So I transitioned to a manager role while I was at Google, was working with a team that was split between San Francisco and Mountain View. And the San Francisco portion of the team was growing very quickly and needed a manager. So I took on those responsibilities. And as a team grew, my management responsibilities grew along with it. At the time, I kind of imagined myself staying on the individual contributor track, tried to stay hands-on, probably to the point of where I was neglecting those engineers I led. So I don't think I had a full respect for everything that goes into being a good manager and supporting teams. So that was definitely a learning experience there.
Do you remember how you realized that you were kind of holding on too much to the individual contributor responsibilities?
Yeah, I guess the problems that arose probably on the manager side, problems with the team that needed a lot more attention than I had been giving them, realized that I really had taken on quite a bit of debt that needed more attention on the organizational side.
What kind of problems popped up?
Yeah. So we had placed a big bet on kind of an infrastructure component. And it was basically in a situation where all the different sub teams across the broader org were dependent on that. And was trying to do a lot of the individual contributor work to get that where it needed to be, rather than probably finding the right people to build out that team. And it's all sort of came crashing down towards the end. There was a lot of difficult interpersonal situations between the tech lead of that team and everyone that was depending on them. It wasn't anything against that engineer. It was really a failure on my own kind of management to set everyone up for success there.
So you've got this cross team dependency that everyone's depending on, and it's kind of bottlenecked on one person, and it kind of took you, were you that person, or was it just took you too long to notice?
Yeah, it was someone on my team, who had kind of kicked off the effort and was leading it through. And then, pressure built as everyone was looking for help there. And it kind of wasn't transitioned to where everyone could understand that component and contribute to it. So it was made for a very challenging and difficult situation there.
Gotcha. So if you were less in the weeds, you would have kind of noticed that situation early and kind of intervened to help all the teams. Is that?
Yeah, absolutely. I would have gotten way ahead of it. I think I didn't have the experience, I think, to be able to pattern match and see that truck coming. So I think it ended up being a learning experience.
So you're at Primer now, and you're doubling, and you're planning to double again. You've seen fast growth at Square. What's the biggest engineering challenge, scaling challenge you've seen on engineering teams?
I think this structure that Primer has creates some challenges of scale, of finding like the right kind of economies of scale. As we build it out, we've split leadership between the machine learning side and the pure software engineering side, and both have engineers on vertical products teams, which I think is a challenge lots of teams face in terms of figuring out whether to align functionally versus vertically, and making trade-offs between those two axes of figuring out where the solid lines are and where the dotted lines are, and navigating those challenges. So building out a leadership structure on this side within that scale is a challenge that we've been facing and will probably continue to face over the next year.
What are the trade-offs you're having to make for other people that may be in that situation where they're working more and more with machine learning, trying to decide how to structure those two orgs?
So we'll have teams that will have maybe two or three software engineers on the side, on the pure software side, and then another probably four, five or more on the machine learning side. And so if we're arranging our leadership style or management structure, so those software engineers roll up on the software leadership track, we either have managers that are embedded in those products teams and have on the order of two reports, which makes for not a very flat structure, or we have managers that try to spread themselves across several teams so that they don't have the full context on any team and can advise within there. So that's kind of the struggle that I'm navigating, and I think the current plan is to balance them and have more kind of player coach roles on each team to work well at that scale. Also leveraging managers on the machine learning side to lead some of the smaller cross-functional teams as well.
Gotcha. So you're instead of having a few managers that manage a lot of people across teams, you have many managers that are leading a few people on their team with full context.
That's kind of the current design. And of course, then that will expect it to scale much better as those teams, double, triple in size in the coming year. And we'll have someone seated that has that context and those relationships.
And did you try something else before you kind of landed on this that gave you some pain? Like, what's the sign that you needed to switch what you were doing?
I think seeing managers struggle being split across teams and not having enough of the day-to-day context to really be able to lead the people that they were managing and contribute and feel like a real owner on any of those teams that they were working with.
I think one like counter I can imagine, I don't know if you had this discussion, is, okay, if we got more leaders, that's fewer people that are available for shipping product because they're doing more management and there's kind of like duplication of effort. How did y'all think about that kind of trade-off?
And that's how we settled on this player coach model, where they will be hands-on. They'll be making individual contributor style contributions and balancing that with managing a small number of engineers on their team. So they'll be right there in the weeds with them. And then as they scale, they'll naturally probably shift away from many of their individual contributor responsibilities.
What advice do you have for engineering leaders looking to improve their offer acceptance rate?
So it's definitely something we struggled with over the past year. Our acceptance rate was somewhere in the 30s, which I knew was not good, which is surprising because I think Primer has such a compelling opportunity. We build machines that read and write, and our mission is to accelerate human understanding of the world. And I think like AI over the next decade is probably one of the most important skill sets to develop and domains to explore, and then will likely be probably the most impactful area to contribute to. So I was looking at all of that and saying, like, am I just doing a terrible job selling this? What's going on? And so we tried like a number of different things, iterated on how I was pitching the company, but really got feedback from the team that, like, hey, our on-site experience is actually kind of brutal. We were putting somebody in a room, giving them a sandwich, and then interviewing and grilling them for an hour. And so many of the candidates wouldn't actually be able to even eat the sandwich. The ones that did, you know, it just didn't feel like a comfortable experience. And so we really weren't presenting the company in a great light there. They weren't getting to know the company through that experience. Meanwhile, because of the low close rate, I was really concerned about the amount of time that my teams were investing in this process. And because of the low close rate, I felt that I had to get a lot of candidates through the system so that at least we'll get the hires that we needed. And it turns out that was kind of wrong on all fronts. So after experimenting with different things, the one thing that really helped there was, rather than trying to compress the on-site down, take up less time from people on the team, actually add a separate lunch slot where three members of the team could take the candidate off-site, get to know them a little bit in an informal setting, not feel like they're being grilled, but let them kind of get to know the rest of the company. And so those people come from across the company in different roles, but bring a lot of perspective, and the personality of the company is really able to shine. We were able to nearly double the close rates with just that one change. And so as a result, the engineers involved have to spend a lot less time interviewing, because we're able to close the engineers that we want to close.
So you've actually, you maybe increased your on-site interview time a little bit, because it's not like sandwich interviewing, but as a result of that double close rate, you spend way less time interviewing.
That's right.
That's an awesome insight. I think that anyone with close rates, I'm seeing somewhere around 2/3 is around normal. So I think anyone listening that's like, it's below that, maybe think about whether people are trying to answer questions with their mouth full of sandwich.
If you look at it in hindsight, of course, that's a terrible experience. And of course, they're going to walk away with a much better impression getting to know people in an informal setting. But we sort of learned that the hard way.
That's the nice thing about hindsight. It always seems obvious, but it never is. So you have a background in improv comedy. How has that impacted your ability to lead engineering teams?
So in my early 20s, one of the things that was really holding me back was a bit of social anxiety. Like it was intimidating to interact with other people. Yeah, and one of the most impactful things that helped grow past that was exploring improv comedy. So being able to collaborate with people in real time in a supportive way, develop kind of a more of a presence, being able to think on your feet, all these different skills really were solidified by exploring improv comedy. And it was tons of fun doing it. Made some great friends along the way, and it was a very, very positive experience for me.
So if there are folks listening that are that those sound like something they want, you know, friends and confidence and ability to think on their feet, to be a better leader of people, what's the best way to get started?
I found a local class that met weekly, I think, for 6 weeks, and then they had a progression of courses. So I think I probably went through five or so of those. The nice thing about this particular class, and I think it's not still in service, although some of my classmates have gone on to start an improv school of their own. But one of the nice tacks that this school took was starting performing from the very first class. So each class would have a graduation show. After we got all the way through, they started a weekly show. So we had the house troupe and would perform weekly. And so got a lot of repetition in through that. Dragged a lot of friends out to my improv shows on a weekly basis, but it was great.
So I've heard you say that we might be swinging towards too contrarian a view, so getting too much pleasure out of saying that the normal things are wrong. Why do you think so?
It's an easy way to sound smart, to disagree kind of with either the best practices or the way everyone's swimming. Like, no one wants to be a sheep, but some people, I think, take it too far. Those people can be very tiresome to be around, like always hearing like the hot take on, you know, what everyone else is thinking. I do think it can be like a very effective investment strategy. If you're placing a lot of bets, you don't want to place them in competitive fields where everyone's kind of swimming in the same direction. It can be a race to the bottom. But I think for each of those companies that you invest in, having kind of the one or two core beliefs that set them apart and make them unique and that kind of thing is all they really need. So if you're going through and being contrarian across the board, you're actually probably wrong more often than you're right. And so if it can distract from the one thing that you really need to be right about, fighting kind of these battles on so many fronts.
So Austin, you have a magic wand and you can spread one idea out into the zeitgeist about engineer hiring that will improve the world. What's the idea that you spread?
I think it's really, really a partnership. So you're both filtering from both sides. And there may be great candidates out there that where your company isn't the perfect opportunity. Like they may have their heart set in a particular direction and it doesn't align with your company. And then vice versa. So I think really putting your company's values and traits out there so people can self-select and self-filter, and then also working with people to understand really what they're looking for, so you can find ways that you're aligned and a good fit or not.
So with Primer, how do you help people that might not be a good fit identify that from the outside or maybe as part of the interviewing process?
So with a company at our stage, a big part of the work is helping making sure that we're tackling the right opportunities. And so if someone really needs a clear picture for what the next 2 years are going to look like, they might want like a larger company that's got a lot more momentum in a particular direction. Primer, meanwhile, is exploring lots of opportunities in the market, helping to define a market in multiple verticals, which is challenging and can be a daunting task. So I think one of the things that I look to put very, very much forward in the interview process is that challenge, so that if that excites them, then that's great that they're a good fit. If that sounds awful to them, then there are great other opportunities that would probably be a better fit.
And do you do that just by saying kind of what you just said, where, you know, we're changing rapidly, and then what does that think, or what's the best way you found to communicate that?
I'll align it also with the particular team that they are interviewing for. So they're interviewing for a team in one of our more mature verticals, where there is like product market fit. It's very clear that people just want more of that. They want it, you know, to scale. They want it fast. They want it on their data and that sort of thing. Then it's a different scenario than in a more nascent vertical that we're exploring, where we think there's tons of opportunity, but that needs to be evaluated. We'll have to try, you know, multiple things, make educated guesses, but to some extent also see what sticks and what's really resonates with the market.
What's a belief about leading teams that younger Austin would have disagreed with?
When I first started leading teams, I felt it was really important to not micromanage. And so what's the opposite of micromanaging? Well, it's delegating and empowering and giving people kind of a lot of runway to really own things. And what I learned over time is it's actually context dependent on what leadership strategy is most appropriate. So you can delegate tasks to someone who is not ready to take them on and set them up for failure and do a horrible job as a leader or as a manager. Whereas if you understand a little bit more of where they are in their development to that, with respect to that particular type of task, you can either coach them along, give them lots of direction if that's what's needed. This concept of situational leadership and really understanding that progress was very influential for me in my career, and even around to delegating. So the people that have this skill set, delegating just doesn't mean totally hands off. It's finding like the right guardrails where they have enough room to run and learn from it, but not so much that they're set up to run off track and fail.
What are some tactics you use to get those guardrails right?
So I think as you're moving into a new transition in someone's career and they're taking on new challenges, finding the right cadence for checking in and kind of evaluating as you're going. So if your first beat or your first thought inclination is to give them a direction in an area, probe that area and see where their thoughts are, so we can hash out a plan more Socratically and see where they take it. And if they draw a blank, or if it doesn't sound like their judgment has been well developed in an area, then that gives you an opportunity to realize, okay, this person may need more direction here to be set up for success.
So check in often, and instead of giving direction, ask for what they would do without you, and then that gives you a chance to kind of right size that guardrail instead of.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. That makes a lot of sense. It worked for Socrates, I guess.
There we go.
Interviews and hiring are weird and not natural. We all make mistakes. Everyone has a story about goofing, either as a candidate or as an interviewer. What's your story?
When a hire doesn't work out, we look back and see what happens. I think the technical process is really important, but I think where I've really iterated and learned is from where we didn't catch kind of behavioral traits or attitudes in interviews. So whenever a hire, thankfully this hasn't happened very often, but when it doesn't work out, I always, you know, look back and say like, okay, what did we miss? How could we have evaluated this in the interview process to really bring it out? And so that's I think what I've learned and where more of my focus has shifted over time.
What are some things that you failed to, some behaviors that you failed to screen for, but now you do screen for, and how do you make that happen?
One thing that's really helpful is to kind of explore how people have navigated challenging situations. And so you can ask about them directly in terms of like, give me an example where, but then you can also, as they're telling their story of interesting technical challenge they've solved or anything like that, cue in on anything that, you know, kind of micro expressions where there's something that you caught as they were walking through that it sounded like maybe it was a bit of a hiccup, and really explore that with them and understand what it was. So if they have a difficult teammate they maybe worked with in the past, what is their attitude toward it? Is it, are they really looking to throw that person under the bus and blame them for everything? Did they have a point of realization where they saw maybe they were doing something that was rubbing the teammate the wrong way, or was there a stylistic difference where they could make some adjustments and really empathize with where the other person was coming from? And if they're able to be self-aware in that way and interpersonally aware in that, that's a really good signal.
So you found drilling in on places where there might be conflict, you might notice a hiccup, maybe an expression or a word, and then that's where you kind of really get to the core of how someone's going to behave.
Yeah, in difficult situations. I also want to see, you know, is there steady states more on the positive side? Do they engage with and get excited about their work? So not only kind of focused in, you know, how do they handle the challenging times, but do want to get a sense of, you know, if we're under a tight deadline, you know, if stuff's hitting the wall, are they going to break down? Are they going to be resilient? Are they going to be good to their team members and supportive through all of it?
Scaling Software Teams is brought to you by my startup, Woven. If you're trying to grow your engineering team as fast as Austin is, you might be feeling some pain around building a steady flow of proven candidates that you know can do the job. I felt that pain in my last role as VP of engineering at a fast-growing software company, and that's why I started Woven. Woven owns the top of your hiring funnel, from resume and application review through vetting on technical aptitude, collaboration, and problem-solving skills. When a candidate lands on your calendar, you know they can build software, so your interviews have a much higher hit rate. If you want to learn more about how Woven could help you scale your software team, check us out at woventeams.com. Now it's time for the rapid fire round. So I'll ask a question and then you'll give us your quick reaction. Are we ready?
Ready.
What's the most impressive thing a candidate has done in an interview that helped you realize they were a great fit?
It's always when they have a moment of like self-reflection, often, sometimes even in the interview, where they realize something that they learned from a situation in the past.
If I were interviewing for a job on your team, what could I do to stand out?
I think come prepared to talk through all of the challenges you faced and the really cool stuff you've built, what you're proud of and what you've learned along the way.
What's a mistake you've seen an engineering candidate make in an interview that they didn't realize they were making?
Sometimes you can see someone that's maybe not particularly self-aware and they rehash a triggering moment with a teammate or whatever and sort of relive it in real time there in the room in a way that's uncomfortable. And you can imagine that in the moment they may have, while no doubt a challenging time, were also probably not the easiest person to interact with.
What does a 6-star culture addition look like for your team?
Someone that has very strong EQ, and by that I mean, you know, able to read other people, see what they need, adapt their style to that, and can kind of read a room and bring energy to that. And I think it's in some ways some of the skill sets that you, circling back to improv, learn going through that, supporting teams, and then also just taking opportunities to delight people.
My guest today has been Austin Broyles. Austin, thank you for being on Scaling Software Teams. Thanks again to Austin for sharing his story with us. Here are a few takeaways I had from my conversation with Austin. Be honest with candidates about the challenges they'll face in the role. Hiring is a two-way street. We want to find a great fit for our team, but the best candidates are also looking to find an organization that fits their needs. Austin's team at Primer is trekking into largely unknown, volatile territory. That excites the right engineers, but is demotivating to the wrong ones. When Austin communicates these challenges upfront, candidates can decide if they're a good fit. Communication skills are software skills. One of the most impactful decisions Austin made in his career had nothing to do with software. By enrolling in improv comedy classes, Austin developed critical skills for leadership, like presenting more effectively, thinking on your feet, and building on others' ideas with yes and. As we look to develop our professional skills this year, we should consider hobbies that have a positive impact on our ability to communicate and work as a team. Use data to drive interview process improvement. Early in his time at Primer, Austin had a problem. He was interviewing great candidates, but he noticed that only 1 out of 3 offers were accepted. This meant that he was spending a lot of time on interviews with candidates who wouldn't take the job. He asked his team for ideas. They suggested that getting grilled with questions while eating wasn't a great candidate experience. They extended the interview to add a no-pressure lunch and time to eat sandwiches. As a result, they saw their offer acceptance rate double. Thank you so much again to Austin for joining us today. I had a blast hearing from him, and now I want to hear from you. If you're enjoying the show, please leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. This will help others find the show.